Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Hi, I'm Ethan Suplee. Welcome to American Glutton. Outside of acting, my two favorite things to do are diet and eat. I have a very complicated relationship with food, and on this podcast, we're going to talk about all of it. Food as entertainment, food as sport, food as fuel. I'll talk to experts and the average person, just like you and me.
I hate to ask you to do anything, but if you're enjoying the show, please take a moment to like, subscribe, rate, review, all of the above on whatever app you're getting it from.
Today on American Glutton, my guest is Doug Bopst. He is the host of the Adversity Advantage podcast. You can find him on Instagram at Doug Bopst. Doug Bopst, welcome to the American Glutton podcast.
Ethan, thanks for having me, man.
Dude, you have a really interesting story, and I just really want to share it with the people who listen to my podcast. But you say going to prison was one of, or if not the best thing that ever happened to you. Please tell me this story.
It was, because when I entered my incarceration for felony drug charges, I was heavily addicted to opiates. I was doing hundreds of milligrams of Oxycontin per day. I was selling tons of pot to not only support my habit, but to also make money. I was a convicted felon. Like I mentioned, I was hopeless. I was having suicidal thoughts, tons of anxiety. And really, I was just emotionally, spiritually, physically, and mentally broken. But what ended up happening to me was when I entered the gates of the detention center, I cried because I didn't want to go in for obvious reasons. And when I left, I cried because I didn't want to leave.
Yeah, dude, I experienced that a little bit leaving rehab for the last time, where I was just like, I mean, it's scary because, like, oh my God, I've kind of figured out life within these parameters, within these confines, and with these barriers set up, I can do life really well. And I'm working this program. And then, like, it's like I'm leaving this structure. It's scary. It's bittersweet. There's a lot to leaving something like that.
There is, right? Because as you'll hear in a second, like, the only thing that was different for me was different for me, like, in as far as like staying clean and staying away from drugs and getting myself, my act together, was my cellmate who helped me transform my life. And so when I entered jail, the first thing I had to do was kick opiates cold turkey for the first few weeks, which I'm sure, as you know, and maybe even your listeners know, it's like having the worst case of the flu, like uncontrollable bowel movements, massive aches and pains that you didn't know existed, you know, anxiety, depression, sleepless nights. But the thing that really was transformative for me, as far as like the one of the feelings that you would experience, is like this feeling that you were trying to crawl out of your own skin and you're trying to like leave your body. Right. And the reason I say it was transformative is because now, like, looking back, I think it was like really God, the universe, whatever you call it, like trying to force the old version of me outside of me so the new me could become whole. And so as I'm detoxing through Oxy, my soon to be cellmate is sitting at one of the tables playing Scrabble. And he looks at me, he's like, "Hey man, what are you doing here?" And then like, I kind of gave this very like low tone answer, like, "Hey, I'm just in here because of, you know, drugs or whatever." And he was like, "Okay, man." And he could just tell that I was unconfident. You know, I was 50 pounds heavier than I am now. I had low self-esteem and just was, my shoulders were rounded forward. And, you know, like I said, head was down, didn't talk too loud. And he said to me, he's like, "You're going to start working out with me when you get through your detox." And I looked at him. I was like, "There's no way in hell I'm going to do that." Because at the time, I could have been a model for Pillsbury. I was like, "There's no way." And Eric looked like a more jacked version of Brad Pitt from Fight Club is how I like to describe him, just to give some context. And later on that day, I saw him, or not too long after that, I saw him work out, and he was doing thousands of push-ups, hundreds of pull-ups, like running all over the common area. I was like, "Who the hell is this guy?" And shortly after that, there was a conversation that happened in the cell that would change my life. And so him and I are talking, and he was asking me more questions about my story. He's like, "You know, why are you in here?" I'm like, "Well, my parents got divorced and girls rejected me and kids bullied me and I got cut from all these sports teams." And he looks at me, he's like, "Quit being a bitch." And I said to him, I'm like, "What do you mean?" Because in that moment, like, I wanted to be coddled and be like, "It's okay, Dougie. Like, you know, the world's against you. Like, it's everybody else's fault." But he's like, "Dude, you're blaming everybody else for your problems but yourself." He was like, "There's plenty of people that were in your circumstances and aren't in jail, right, Doug?" And I'm like, "Yep." He's like, "You chose to get yourself here." He's like, "You have two choices. You can be a man, look yourself in the mirror, and know that it's up to you to change the future of your life. Like, nobody's coming to save you." Or he's like, "You can be a bitch, go cry in the corner and say, 'Woe is me,' and blame everybody else for your problems and feel sorry for yourself." He's like, "Most people will do that." So of course, the last thing I wanted to do was to be a bitch, right? and also, like, I had this like kind of aha moment, because the drugs at that point had been, you know, out of my system and was starting to get through like a little bit. Like, I started to get through the days that I was in, and I was like, "You know what? Like, I clearly don't have everything figured out." At that point, I was 21 years old. I had 21 jobs. I was in this my own mental health crisis. I was, you know, heavily addicted to drugs before that and selling drugs. So I knew that, like, man, like, clearly what I was doing before wasn't working. Let's try something else. And that inspired me to start working out in jail. And when I started to work out, I could barely hold myself up to do a push-up from my knees, could hardly walk up and down the steps. But with his motivation training me in there every single day during my 90-day sentence, I was able to do a set of 10 push-ups and run a mile by the time it was all said and done. And it was super transformative to me. I mean, it taught me a lot of things that I needed to learn to be taught, like the importance of self-discipline, like really like following through with the things I said I was going to do. It taught me the importance of, you know, getting comfortable, being uncomfortable, because, you know, you and I talked about this on my podcast, but before I went to jail, I couldn't embrace discomfort at all. Anytime I would get stressed, I'd do a drug. Every time I was anxious, I would do a drug. Every time I would, you know, get into a fight with somebody, I would do a drug, whatever it was. And so I wasn't used to dealing with my emotions. And in jail, there's nowhere to run. There's nowhere to hide. I wasn't the type of person that was going to get into a bunch of fights. So, you know, me running my mouth when I was upset wasn't going to work for me. You know, obviously access to drugs isn't what it is on the streets in jail. So all these things that prevented me from escaping, where I really had to look myself in the mirror and figure out, how do I deal with these emotions in a healthy way? So that was helpful. And the other thing was just like really establishing this belief in myself that I think was just, it was there, you know, before it was just so buried down because of all the stuff that had happened in my life. And obviously a lot of the stuff that I did to myself, that I found that belief in myself again. And it was just very transformative for me to be able to get motivated to finally take the initial steps to start to transform my life. And so the day I left jail, I cried because I didn't want to leave, because, like, again, this guy had come into my life with no skin in the game as far as my life and chose to really help save my life while I was in jail. And so I said to him, I'm like, "How can I ever repay you?" And he told me not to mess up and to pay it forward. And he gave me a workout plan that I still have framed in my place today. So I never forget where I came from, got out, stayed on the path, you know, lost a bunch of weight, became a trainer to help other people transform their lives. And like the rest is history. I mean, a lot's happened in between then, but that's really the story of how jail, you know, transformed my life.
Dude, it's so amazing. You said so many things in there that I want to take up. Like, first of all, I think his skin in the game is literally like, he's saving his life by saving your life. You know what I mean? Like, that's his skin in the game, is like, he has to be responsible for you also in order for you to be responsible for yourself to change, to keep him on track, whatever that means. That's like how I'm relating to it. Like, what's your skin in the game today? Your skin in the game today is still saving yourself. That's why you do this, right? Another thing you said is the piece on personal responsibility. You know, there's so many discussions on personal responsibility, and so many people want to talk about nuance and how there are environmental factors, and fine, that's all true. Fine. I think that it's perspective. That's all it is. You cannot say objectively that any person has zero responsibility in any situation, right? Objectively, if they're there, they got themselves there. Somehow there is some portion that they contributed to. But I think that the responsibility needed to progress, to change, is entirely personal. And so in order to do that, why not just look at everything as I put myself here? Do you know what I mean? Because at the end of the day, you could fucking spend a lot of time sitting around splitting hairs over why McDonald's is partially responsible for your condition. Where does that get you? It gets you nowhere. It does not handle your condition. Your condition is entirely within you to handle. And maybe you need a guy like Eric. Eric is his name, right?
Yeah.
Or someone like you today to start talking about how it was entirely your burden to solve, your burden to fight through, so that another guy can go like, I see that. As long as I'm thinking about what somebody has done to me, I can't get better. You can't move on from that point if it's somebody else's doing. Even if you get hit by a car and you have to do a bunch of physical therapy, the guy whose car hit you, he can't do the physical therapy for you. You have to do the physical therapy. It's up to you to get better. So why not take on the entire burden of responsibility and go, I did all of it. So I am all powerful and I can change whatever the fuck I want. I just think it's like a better position to take charge from, you know?
Absolutely. And I think the moment you give your power away to somebody else or something else, like, it's over, right? Yeah. I mean, the game over. I think it's hard for people. Again, I'm not justifying that kind of behavior. I think it's hard for people to look themselves in the mirror and understand that there's work that needs to be done when they're in a low place in their life, because their life is already so bad that it's like they don't have the confidence or the level of secureness to look themselves in the mirror and say, you know what, like, I got some work I need to do. Because when they're in that place, it's like there's so many other things that are going wrong in their life that the last thing they want to be able to do, the last thing they want to do is to have to say, you know what, there's other things in my life that I need to fix. But you're right. Like, the only way out, the only way, is to take full responsibility, because nobody's coming to save you. And throughout the course of my life, I was looking for things to save me in healthy and unhealthy ways, right? Like, when I was younger, I was looking for substances. I was looking for the validation I got from selling drugs. I was looking for, you know, being able to fit in with certain crowds to come and save me from my own brokenness. And obviously that got me to jail. But even after I got out of jail, I looked for validation from like vanity and like the way I looked, or getting attention from girls, or success, or money, or whatever it was, to save me from like doing the actual work. And it wasn't until I like looked myself in the mirror and said, you know what, like, none of this stuff matters. Like, none of this stuff matters for your long-term happiness and fulfillment if you're not happy with yourself on the inside, if you're not doing the work. Because while like fitness is important, relationships are important, success is important. All those things are, they have some level of importance. But when you're using those things to dictate how you feel about yourself, it's a very, very slippery slope. And that's why I've really had to reevaluate, even like the last few years, my relationship with fitness and health. Not that I don't exercise frequently, because I do. I still work out 5-6 days a week. But it got to a place like where I was constantly looking at myself in the mirror to say, okay, like, do I still have my 8-pack? Do I still have my 6-pack? Do I still have all the abs? Like, are my arms getting bigger? Like, how come I don't have as many veins today? Or I'm stepping on the scale and, you know, traveling on airplanes with food. And for me, that became really unhealthy because I was isolating myself from other people. And I was hiding from the fact that there was still a lot of insecurities inside of me that I needed to deal with.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I totally get that. Like, my personal physical goals have utterly shifted. Like, I still like to have the hint of abs in the right lighting. You know, in my shower, there's a perfect light, spotlighting, downlighting, right? And if I see myself with no abs in the morning when I'm taking a shower, I'm like, what the hell is going on? This is out of control. But like, there's a difference between that and preparing for a photo shoot, which takes like 6 weeks of really, really hard work to get veins to show up in my abdomen. You know what I mean? And that's the kind of thing where it's just like, how do I want to live my life forever? You know, I've lost 300 pounds. If I'm not under or around 10% body fat, that's okay. You know, right. It's okay to not be the leanest version of me that's possible. It's okay to be within the band of quote unquote healthy body fat percentage, you know?
Yeah. And I'm glad you brought up like getting ready for a photo shoot, because that is totally different than like what I was.
That's not life. Yeah.
Yeah. What I was dealing with was like years of this. It wasn't just like a period of months. This was like years of me being afraid of eating anything that wasn't in the typical like bodybuilding physique meal plan. And my logic for this was, I was so scared of going back to that version of myself who I was before jail, that I was like, all right, if I eat pizza, that's what old fat Doug would do. So does that mean that I'm going to become that person? Or if I eat ice cream, like, I'm going to do this. And so I just became so afraid of going back to that old version of myself that I just stayed away from all that stuff. Plus, I was continuing to chase like the next thing, the next rush with my vanity, because I thought that as a kid, like, the things that made me most miserable as a kid were girls picking on me and rejecting me, my weight and how I looked in the mirror, and the fact that I just didn't see myself as successful. So I thought that, well, the opposite must be true, that if I get ripped, I'll get attention and I'll be happy, that if I get attention from girls, I'll be happy. If I have success, I'll be happy. And so I started to get ripped, but I still wasn't happy. So yeah. I'm like, well, maybe I'm just not ripped enough. So then I got to get more ripped and more ripped. And it becomes this lose-lose game, to where you start to realize like, A, you've lied to yourself for years because you've chased this thing that just doesn't exist, right? And B, it's like, what am I doing? Like, is this really what happiness looks like? Is sitting in my room on a Friday and Saturday night and eating tilapia and broccoli and not going out with my friends, not having a social life? Like, is that what this is supposed to be about? And, you know, it took some time because I had this level of cognitive dissonance that, you know, I know, you know, Mark Wahlberg, and I've been told a lot through the years that I look like Mark. And when I first got told that in my like mid-20s or early 20s or whatever, after I lost all the weight, I didn't believe it, or I thought it was an insult, because when I was a kid, I was called all kinds of names. I was told I looked like people that, you know, in my mind weren't attractive. So I was like, I don't look like that. There's no way. Like, there's no way I see it. Yet everybody would tell me that. And I still saw this, like, the fat version of me when I looked in the mirror, even though all the weight was gone. I don't know if you can relate to this, but I still saw that person in the mirror. And it wasn't until I started going to like therapy and understanding that that was all kind of normal based on you know, growing up and then being bullied and picked on. Again, I'm not blaming that for anything. I think that's just the reality of when you're bullied and picked on and you see yourself a certain way, you start to believe that and your brain just gets hardwired from a young age to see that. And so through therapy, I was able to A, understand why that was normal. And then that made me feel a little bit better that that was normal. And then I could, you know, work through it through, you know, affirmations, writing down like literally like what type of person I was before I went to jail and then writing down who I am now, like really talking to people that I trusted to get their honest opinion on the way I looked. And, you know, over time and doing that work consistently, I started to really shift and see myself as somebody who was a completely different person.
Yeah. I relate to this so much. My cousin recently sent me a picture that he one of his, I think his sister posted on Facebook or something, and it's all of us when we were children. So it's like early 80s. And I look at this kid and I'm like, why the fuck would that kid for a second have any body issues? There's not one thing that I could be critical of him for. And it's a picture of myself. And my entire childhood is plagued with the memory of feeling like I don't fit in, like my body is wrong, like I'm fat, like I'm grotesque. And I look at this kid and I'm like, it's just not true. So I think a lot of that, I think many people are experiencing that. And for some of us, it's worse than for others. And you know, the people who actually are truly vain, you know, I think they're probably working at their physiques pretty hard. You know what I mean? And yeah. and like for some of us, it takes more work. And I'm so glad you started seeing somebody and talking about this and cutting yourself some slack, because I think that's important too. You know, I think that somebody who's 500 pounds has a decent road in front of them of diligence and consistency, right? And building habits and all of that. But at the same time, I think that that aspect of whatever they're dealing with doesn't have to be forever. And that there should come a point where they get to where you're at, where it's like, okay, a slice of pizza is not going to end my life. I've lost hundreds of pounds. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And I just wish that pizza and ice cream and all that stuff, you know, didn't contain a lot of the stuff that it contains, so that it wouldn't change your weight that much when you woke up in the morning. Because I would eat like a couple slices of pizza, which probably was only like 800 calories, right? And then I would get up in the morning and I'd be like 10 pounds heavier. And I'd be like, what the fuck? Like, yeah. What the hell did I do? Right. And of course, then your mind starts to go to, well, wait, did I really gain 10 pounds? Or, I mean, I know that it said 800 calories, but why is the scale up? And then you start to believe that will actually contribute to that much weight gain. And what you don't understand is that contains tons of, you know, salt and, you know, fat and all this stuff that can bloat you, right? And carbs and stuff like that. And especially for somebody who doesn't eat carbs or wasn't eating a lot of carbs, I should say, back in the day.
Right. Your muscles are sucking up that glycogen, right? It's like probably developed zero fat from the pizza at all, but your muscles are full and like so happy with the carbs, you know?
Yeah. But, you know, I'm glad that we're talking about this, because I think a lot of people, they struggle with looking for that thing to come and like fix them.
Yeah.
You know, and I know you've been there. I've been there. I think a lot of people obviously have, in that, you know, I thought that in order for me to be liked by people and to be able to get a girlfriend or to be able to like be valued by people, that I needed to look a certain way. And I started to do stuff for other people. I started to seek validation because I wanted to get the approval from others, not because I wanted it to do it myself. It was more for other people. And then you end up getting lost and you end up losing track of who you really are and what you actually like value about yourself and what you want to do in your life.
Yeah. And I would suspect that the majority of the people that we're talking about or talking to, who have, whether it's body dysmorphia or legitimate things about their body that they want to change that are changeable, they don't consider themselves who they are to be based on the worth of their body, right? And so this idea that you are going to therefore have more value because you change your body. It's just like a silly thing. Like, I'm the exact same way. I always thought as a kid, like, a girl could love me if she just got to know me, but they'll never get to know me because I have this body that I have. So I have to get a good body in order for a girl to love me. It was just, it's just nonsense.
Yeah. And the problem is, like, I think a lot of times when we're in those situations, like, we, when we don't love ourselves or we don't trust ourselves or whatever the example is, it's hard for other people to do the same with us. Right. And so I found that to be the case, like, again, around the same time where I was still dealing with a lot of the darkness from my past. I mean, sure, I had stayed away from the drugs I was abusing. Sure, I had, you know, built a career out of what happened to me in jail. Like, all that stuff was true, but I still hadn't forgiven myself for what I had done in the past. I still hadn't forgiven my parents. Like, I had so much resentment towards my mom for kicking me out when I was 16, when she caught me with weed. I had resentment towards her for, and what I felt like she wasn't there for me when I needed her the most. Now, again, like, looking back now, it's like, her and I have a great relationship, and I know she was doing the best she could with the tools that she had. Because, you know, I tell people, like, people have to remember, like, this is nearly 20 years ago when she kicked me out. Like, mental health, addiction, like, all this stuff wasn't talked about like it is now. Now it's front and center, I would say, of most everybody's minds. And so I had resentment towards her for that. I had resentment towards her for, even when I got out of jail initially, I felt like she still wasn't, like, believing me, right? Because as addicts, it's like, we could screw up for 10 years, and the minute we're clean or sober, whatever the, whatever you are, for 10 days, we expect everybody to fully trust us again, right? And it's just, well, not,
yeah. And don't you think we also spend a lot of times lying to people in the build up to that? Like, I know from when I was an addict and dealing with addicts today, which isn't super common, but it happens. Like, a person who hasn't really gotten some sober time under their belt, they're just liars. They're right. They're lying. They're first lying to themselves, because I think they're actually, what they're saying to you, they believe, but you just can't. I just take it with a grain of salt. You know, like, somebody who's 7 days sober, who's trying to tell me they figured it all out and they're fine now, and like, they're doing great. Give them all the responsibility and trust back that you would to somebody who never had those problems. I'm keeping them at arm's length, because I think it takes a while to really build that foundation of responsibility.
100%. And I think that when people are, like, just yearning for that instant validation from family and friends right away, it's like, there's still work to do, that to know that, you know, they shouldn't expect anything from anybody. And that if they're looking for validation right away, that it's like, all right, like, how are you truly feeling about yourself and where you're going? Because you're trying to convince somebody that your life is fully turned around, when a logical person would say, there's no way, right? It's been 3 days or 3 weeks or whatever. And so what it forced me to really do, as far as my mom, is I knew that there was nothing I could personally do to make her like me or show love in a certain way. Nothing. The only thing I could do is work on my side of the street, right? And make sure that I was doing everything that I possibly could every single day to improve myself, to improve my life, to improve the way I manage stress, to improve the way I communicated with people, to be able to get to a place where, when she was ready, we were able to come and have a conversation that, you know, was transformative in our relationship, where we essentially sat down over dinner one night and we were just talking, and she was like, you know, is there anything you wish I would have done differently, like, with how I handled things? And at that point, I had been, again, working on myself for a bit of time. So it wasn't like, well, you fucked me up, you shouldn't have. It was like, I was like, Mom, you know, I understand you just did, like, the best you could. I was like, I honestly just wish you would have just asked me, like, why? Like, why am I doing those things? Because deep down, I was really struggling, you know, from the bullying in the school really, really impacted me. I mean, I was, one of my nicknames was Down Syndrome Doug in grade school. And so I had started to convince myself that there was something wrong with me, because I was like, why are these kids calling me this? Like, I think I'm pretty smart. Like, I'm not, you know, act. I didn't think that it made sense, but I'm like, well, maybe I am, right? And so, and there was other things that I was called and stuff, and that made me want to check out because I was experiencing so much pain. And then, you know, other things like not making the sports teams when I love sports, and just my, even my family, some of my family relationships that were impacting me. And so because I was a teenager, and it's like, you're not really taught how to open up and share stuff like that. You know, that was something that I just wish we could have had a better conversation on. And who knows if she'd even asked me that, if I had been willing to share, but you know, the fact that she asked me what she could have done differently, then I'm like coming to her and being like, you know, here's what I would have done differently. And then yeah, you're able to say, cause it's like what I've learned is, you know, I was ready to say I was sorry and I have to forgive my mom for a long time. But I feel like we wait until the other person does it first. And it's like, as soon as they do it, then it's like, well, yeah, I'm sorry too, right? And so that was something that really helped me let go of a lot of the painful moments of my past, was knowing that I could have a decent relationship with my mom again. And with my dad and I, you know, we've never really seen eye to eye, specifically when I was younger. And it just got to the point where, you know, I love my dad. And I think that without him, I wouldn't, you know, be where I'm at today. It's because it's like what I haven't valued in relationships when I was a kid, I now have learned like what I actually want and don't want when I get older. And I've just learned to just accept him for who he is, and then just have the best relationship I can. Because before I just would resent him and I was filled with deep anger, but it took a lot of work and therapy and learning to forgive him. And then also know that like, I'm also flawed, right? In that I'm a hypocrite if I'm expecting people to forgive me if I continue to mess up or I do things out of character, but yet I'm not willing to do the same for other people. So all of that was stuff that became very helpful in me coming to terms with a lot of stuff that happened to me in my past.
Yeah. I mean, it I think like,
if you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello? Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
You know, I wanted sobriety to fix me. I wanted a diet to fix me. I expected many times for all of my issues to be resolved by taking part in some other thing. And then, you know, I think there's some sense of peace in going like, I'm a work in progress forever, you know?
Yeah.
Like, this is not, whatever's going on might get better, but I don't think it's ever going to go away completely. It's going to constantly take some kind of work or effort or something like that. And I think that that's really powerful to be able to go back and forgive people, you know, and have those conversations are super, super helpful. I think that contributes to personal growth quite a bit.
It does, because like you begin to, once you understand the process of forgiveness, and like you said, that we're this continuous work of progress, you begin to accept the fact that none of us are perfect. And I think we're all doing the best we can most of the time with like the tools we have, the level of self-awareness we have, the level of self-esteem that we have. And you just learn to understand people more.
Yeah.
You know,
it was really profound when I became a parent. And there was a point, you know, it wasn't when my kids were babies, but when you start to recognize that this thing that you consider has been entirely of your shaping, right? You're, first of all, it's your progeny. Biologically, you've contributed to creating it. And then through your actions and behaviors, you've contributed to it, its upbringing. And so there's this idea like it's my thing that, like, you know, almost like if you were doing a drawing or something, right? And you're like, wait a second, this drawing is drawing itself also. And there was a point where I had to go like, oh, my kids are also human beings and people, and their ideas and ideals are not going to sync up with mine perfectly, that I was also able in that moment to apply that to my parents, because I never really thought of my parents as human beings. They were my parents. And I held a lot of, I think, animosity towards certain things that they had done to me. And if I looked at what I considered they had done to me through the lens of parents trying to raise kids, it became a lot easier for me to go like, oh, I get it. No, I get it. They did the best they could as people with kids from their point of view, from their perspective. They were doing what they were supposed to do. And that doesn't mean that that's how I have to do it. And that doesn't mean that the way I do it is the way my kids have to do it. Because again, I'm a person separate from my parents, and my kids are people separate from me also. I don't know. It was a lot for me to bestow humanity upon my parents. You know what I mean? And go like, beyond just my parents, you're people. And people have all kinds of shit going on that's imperfect. There's no perfect person.
Yeah, 100%. And I think I'm so glad that you brought that up, because I think that, you know, so many times, especially I think when I started to do personal development, for instance, and I started to get into health and fitness, I assumed that everybody else should behave like me. I believe that everybody else should be going to therapy. Everybody else should be like working on their level of self-awareness and all these other things that happens when you like embark on that journey. And the reality is, like, there's a lot of people that's just not going to be what they want to do. And that's okay. Right. And that we're all different, and we all have different interests, and we all have different things that make us tick. And it also, as I like got further down the path, I realized that everybody's human and we all make mistakes, and people, there's plenty of things that I did in my past and the way I treated other people that I would be so embarrassed to say some of the things that I did. And so if I'm saying that, then how can I, you know, judge somebody else for some of the mistakes that they've made in their past? And I just think that the more you understand that we're all human and that we're all doing the best you can, the more you begin to not only understand how to forgive somebody, but to not take things so personally.
Yeah. Yeah. The wildest thing as a parent, again, and this also comes through being a sober person who has had many conversations with many other sober people, is like, man, I can think of the worst shit that I've done that is completely embarrassing and makes me feel like I'm an unforgivable person. And then I can have a conversation with somebody where they are able to take that in, digest it, and go, wow, here's what I got. And then tell me a story that's even worse. Right. And so, you know, with my kids, I'm just like, listen, I want open communication. There's nothing you can tell me that is going to, you know, I suppose somebody could come home, you know, one of my daughters could come home and tell me, like, by the way, I'm in a gang and I just did a drive-by shooting, and I might fall out of my chair with shock. You know what I mean? Yeah. But like, I don't really foresee that happening. And so within the realm of what's going on with typical adolescence, I'm like, I was also an adolescent. I also did crazy shit. And like, I'm not going to react in a crazy way. Like, that's the other thing. Like, the day I realized that my father had also been an 18-year-old guy with all the shit that 18-year-old guys do, he had always just been this figure for me that was like beyond reproach. He went to work. He never drank. He was decent and moral, and like, you didn't fuck with him. You know what I mean? You got in big trouble if you didn't follow the rules. And so like a guy like that, I couldn't picture also having broken rules as a kid. I couldn't picture him as a kid. And so when my kids have anything, it's really an interesting conversation of going like, hey, I'm not going to judge you and get mad at you and tell you you're a bad person. Like, let's just have a conversation as two people. What's going on? And what are your thoughts? And where do you feel you fucked up that I can possibly help you with without just making you feel like garbage, you know?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think it's really cool that you've been able to develop this level of like awareness and just understanding around parenting, around kids, so that you can acknowledge how your father was, but then also in the same conversation, know like certain things that you might do differently, right, with your kids. And I think that's an important place to be where you can, I mean, because a lot of times what happens is there's two extremes. There's the just the sole blaming of the parents, right? And then that becomes like an excuse for other behavior in the future. Or there's like the other side where it's like, well, I'm just going to do what my parents did because that's just the way that I'm wired. Right. And I think two things can be true. I think that you can acknowledge that your parents acted a certain way and that probably did, you know, contribute to your wiring and conditioning, whatever you would call it, but you can also change and do things differently while also understanding that however you were raised, you know, your parents are human.
Yeah. It was for me, especially in relation to my kids, there was a struggle because for a long time, and to your point where you talked about like, you were making progress with therapy and having a diet in place and an exercise routine, and everybody should just do that. And I felt much the same way. You know, there were diets where I was like, you know, people should not be eating gluten. Gluten is poisoning America. You know, I think I read like Grain Brain when it came out, and yeah, it became this big thing with me of like, this is what's the bane of, you know, Western societal addiction to grains and processed foods. And, you know, there was this idea of what my kids should be, how they should think. I had very, kind of stringent ideas about right and wrong. And I had to give that up, man. I had to give up this sense of like, what is right for me is not necessarily right for everyone. But like, my desire would be for everyone to find their sense of right and wrong and live in that way, which I think is more important than everyone adhering to what I find to be right and wrong. Because at the end of the day, people drink and it's not a problem for them. People go to McDonald's and it's not a problem for them. And if it's not a problem for them, I don't need to make it a problem for them. Do you know what I mean? Like,
100%.
What what has been a problem for me is not necessarily going to be a problem for my kids. I'm trying still to, like, it almost got to the point where I turned everything into like flavors of ice cream, you know, like, am I going to be mad at my kid if she prefers chocolate to French vanilla? I'm not going to be mad at her. She's allowed to prefer whatever flavor of chocolate she likes. And so I would take that out. And, you know, obviously there's extremes. If my kid came to me and tried to sell me on cannibalism and why cannibalism is right for her, I would have to have a serious talk with her like that. I would go like, well, there's going to be a lot of problems with wanting to eat people, right? But like, if you take it down into the normal everyday stuff, there's going to be a lot we disagree on. And I can't be absolutely right about any of that for them. I can only figure out what's true and right for me and try to live a moral life based on that, set a good example for them, and then hope for the best and expect that they're going to be different people. And then I apply that to my parents too and go like, God, a lot of my strife in life came from this idea that people were not behaving in the way I wanted them to behave. And really, I think it was really mostly that I wasn't behaving in the way that was appropriate for me to behave.
Yeah, there's so much there that, and it all makes so much sense, because I think that what you just said is so true. It's like, when we're not happy with ourselves, we look for people to point the finger at, right? Because it just makes us feel better about ourselves. Like, again, going back to what we talked about, like towards the beginning of our conversation, like when we're feeling like low about ourselves, it's hard to like look in the mirror and say, you know what, like I got something I need to fix. It's easy to say, you know what, well, that person's doing that. So I guess I'm okay. And I had a similar shift where, you know, you talked about that everybody should cut out gluten and everybody should diet a certain way. As a personal trainer, I think the moment where a trainer goes from like good to great is the moment where they really stop assuming that everybody else has the same like lifestyle and schedule and level of discipline that they may have. Because early in my career, you know, I would get parents with like four kids, and you'll appreciate this, and I'd be like, just get up earlier, get up at four, make the time. Like, what are you doing? Like health as well, like all this stuff. And then I realized, like, the more I trained people with kids, and I was like, man, their schedule is kind of overwhelming. I mean, they're taking them to
a lot, yeah. You
know, four different practices. They're, you know, sleepless nights. They got to make dinner, then they got to do this, they got to do that. And so then it became, all right, how can I effectively help them just fit fitness into their schedule, right? Because them being consistent is much better. Even them being consistent with just working out a few days a week it's much better than them being erratic and, you know, working out a week straight and then not working out for a few weeks or a month. And I say that because it kind of goes in line with what we're saying, in that not everybody is going to be like you.
Right.
Right. Not everybody's going to have that same passion for different things, and that's okay. And so I think it's important to, you know, obviously understand what makes you tick and what's important to you, while also like trying to spend time with people that, you know, you also may not always agree with, that might have different opinions than you, that maybe have different lifestyle habits than you or whatever. Cause that then you learn from them, they learn from you. And it's not to say that you should hang out with people that are treating you a certain way. I'm not saying that. I'm saying that I think that we live in this world where we expect everybody to be like us, and that we're the way we are is the way that everybody else should be. And it's just so far from the truth.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it goes back to that, what you were talking about in the beginning with the personal responsibility. Like, the minute we give the power to somebody else, we take the power away from us. And I do think it's a tough sell to assume that a guy who's 500 pounds, sedentary, subsisting on just almost strictly processed foods, you know, like maybe on the cheeseburger, there's some lettuce. And so you can say like, okay, well, that's a step in the right direction. To say that it is entirely up to you. I almost want them to come to that understanding very slowly, right? Because you can take that point of view, because it is just a point of view. There's no truth to it more than just a way of looking at the world. And you can go too hard in the paint and get onto some really unsustainable program and just go like, it's all up to me. So now every day I've got to kill myself in physical activity. I've got to starve myself of food and I've got to experience this pain. And it's like, that might not, you might not get very far doing that, right? And so I think there's like a almost a progressively a steady way to get to there that is more than just shut up, bitch, which I understand worked for you in that moment. But I doubt that in that moment you overcame everything.
No.
You know what I mean? Like, overcoming everything takes some time. It's slow. It's gradual. But I think that kind of shift can be as much as shut up, bitch. Like, I love when David Goggins says shut up, bitch, to himself, right? Like, he's telling his inner bitch to shut up. I love that. That doesn't mean that I can run 100 miles today. I can't. I can't run 3 miles today. I can't run. I can barely run across my yard, but I could do cardio for an hour and a half. You know, I could get my heart rate up to 150 and keep it there for an hour and a half, but I can't really run. And so I'm going to keep, you know, if I want to run, it's going to be this slow and steady progressive thing that I work towards. So I really like shut up, bitch. But I think that for a guy who is morbidly obese and maybe even addicted to some drugs, and I think shut up, bitch could be like, shut up, bitch, I'm going to walk to the end of my driveway today. And then shut up, bitch, I'm going to walk to the street tomorrow. And then shut up, bitch, I'm going to walk to the corner the day after that. Whatever it is, it doesn't have to be, you know, I'm responsible for the entire universe on day one and I can do anything.
Right. Well, I think, you know, the underlying message of the conversation with my cellmate in jail was what was most important. Like, the language, obviously, being called a, you know, a bitch in jail, or being called a bitch in general, is like something you don't want to be called. Right. And also, it was at a time where I had started to understand that whatever was I was doing in my life wasn't working. And I really, for some reason, this guy had what I had. I mean, he was in jail. Not that I really wanted that, but he had this physique. He was ripped. I mean, he was in great shape and I wanted that. So I'm like, all right, I'm going to listen to whatever this guy tells me to do. And so, you know, I started to understand that, yes, this was my responsibility and my fault. And that has been the underlying theme of my own internal messaging when I go through hard times or when the pandemic happened or whatever, where it's like, it's not shut up, bitch. It's like, dude, nobody's coming to rescue you. Like, you have to take full responsibility for this. You can't blame the government. You can't blame this. You can't blame that. Like, that's not going to work anymore. Like, you have to take full responsibility for where you're going. And I think that having that back up against the wall mentality, which was built when I was in jail, has really served me, because when I hit adversity, you know, I don't curl up in a ball. You know, I may take some time to process it, but then it's like, all right, how can I take action to like find a way to make my situation better? But it's also had a negative effect, because it's all, I also, even when things are good, I still feel like my back's up against the wall, even if that makes sense, to where I still feel like I have to push and push and do the next thing and do the next thing, when really the best thing to do in that moment is just to chill and just like celebrate like where I've come. I don't know if that makes sense.
Oh no, it totally does. No, I think that I think that that's right. I think, you know, it's hard for, before you've made a lot of progress, it's hard to be responsible for everything in the past. That's sure. Hard. But I think that the point of view that I think is necessary is I have to be responsible for everything in the future. And right. That's easier. And once you get there, then you can start applying it to the past. Then it's kind of easy to look back and go like, oh, I caused that and I caused this. Once you've taken ownership of moving forward, made progress, seen what you're capable of, it's easy to look back and go like, no, I fucked that situation up too. And here's how, you know, but I do think the better step isn't like, you're 500 pounds, you caused it. You need to take ownership of having caused it. I don't think that's as valuable as you need to take ownership of everything moving forward. I think that is a more valuable piece, right? Who fucking cares about the past? We're not existing in the past. We're existing in the present and looking towards the future. So own that, period. And if you want to look back at the past and own that later, fine, who cares? But like, you can't really change what happened in the past. You can change how you look at it. And that might affect the way you move forward.
Yeah. There's so much gold there. And I think one of the things that helped me with that was, you know, I think as addicts, we get focused on instant gratification. So for me, like I wanted to, you know, lose all the weight and get ripped as fast as possible. But like really before my journey started in jail from a health and fitness perspective, I was talking to Eric and I was like, how long is it going to take me to like get ripped? And he's like, how long you been fucking up your body? I'm like, a long time. He's like, it's going to take a long time, Doug. And so it made me realize that like, it wasn't going to happen overnight, but I knew that I had a target. And for me, what helped was I had like a vision of who I wanted to be, you know, and not in any kind of like woo woo way. I just knew that I wanted to be fit. I wanted to have a better level of self-esteem. And I knew that if I did certain things every single day, that it would give me a chance to become that person. It wasn't going to guarantee that I would be there, but it gave me a chance. And so I would build off of those small wins early on. I would build off of, you know, doing the one pushup for my knees and doing the one pushup for my feet and doing sets of pushups and stuff like that. And then that gave me the confidence to keep going, right? And that gave me also understanding of what I needed to do to keep the progress going, because I saw what was working for me. I knew that I had to get a certain level of number of steps in. I knew I had to do, you know, calisthenics. I had to eat a certain way. And I think what people don't realize is they're looking to go from like couch to 5K in a matter of seconds and thinking that's going to be the thing that builds their self-confidence. And what I've experienced, and I know like a lot of other people have experienced from making these big transformations, is I find the biggest levels of confidence come from like going from zero to one, zero to two. It's like getting yourself out of a place where your life feels so dark or you feel so defeated, and just having the courage to get up and start moving again. Yeah. And I think that in itself is like one of the biggest levers you can pull to build confidence.
No, I totally agree. And for anyone out there whose goal is a 5K, get ready to set another goal right when you finish the 5K. Like as you're crossing the finish line, get ready to fucking start something new, because if you don't want to go back to what you were doing before you started your 5K goal, like that's like, for me, I want to have new goals all the time. I want to be constantly making goals, or just I get static and I start to relapse, you know, and revert. And it's like, that's not fun, you know? I do have a question that I'm dying to ask you, which is within the structure of jail with Eric, like, by the way, fucking thank God for Eric. I feel like what a great celly to have, you know what I mean? Like you're working out with this Adonis. I understand leaving would have terrified me to no end. What did you do? What was your program? What was your mindset? How did you act in the real, quote unquote, real world once all those confines were lifted?
It was tough, man, because, you know, going to like when I got out of jail. So when I went to court, first of all, my sentence was I went to court in September 30th of 2008. He said, the judge sentenced me to 5 years, everything suspended, but 90 days, meaning if I messed up, I could have potentially gone back and done the full 5 years, 5 years probation, 200 hours of community service, all kinds of fines. But he also sentenced me to drug classes. So that to me was like my outpatient treatment. Like I didn't go to AA. I didn't go to NA. Not that I was ever against that. I just, that wasn't my part of my path. Like I just knew that I got out of jail, I was going to move in with my grandparents, who have been very instrumental in my life and in my transformation. And they gave me some great structure. They gave me this level of love with also accountability. And what they did was they're like, hey, you can move in here. You don't have to pay rent. We'll pay for your food. We'll give you spending money. But here's the deal. You're going to bring us receipts for any money we give you. And if it doesn't match up with what you told us it's for, you're out. You're going to come home at a certain time. You're going to work to get a job. You're going to work out. You're going to do all the things that they knew was going to help me change. But if I didn't follow those things, it was going to result in me not being able to live there anymore. Had that in place, had the outpatient like drug rehab, where it's just kind of like you go to like a class a few days a week, you got to pass drug tests. And I don't know if it was a few days a week or once, I forget what it was, but something where, you know, you go and you would sit like similar, I'm sure, in like treatment and talk about like addiction and stuff. So that gave me another level of accountability. And then being on probation where you're having to report to a probation officer was another added level of accountability, because I was mortified of going back to jail. So I was like the guy that just kind of did everything I needed to do from that perspective and made sure that I was in compliance with parole and probation. As far as like dealing with a lot of the emotional stuff that I hadn't really learned to deal with outside of jail, like I mentioned, you know, before, I was always escaping.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
In jail, I was thankful enough that I was in there a long enough time that I was able to reestablish behavior to emotion, to where I got used to, if I got angry, I would work out. If I got upset, I would work out, or I'd journal, or I'd run, or whatever the case may be. So that when I got out, when I still was overwhelmed with stress, uncertainty, fear, I would find ways to exercise. And that became actually a great way for me to process some of the pain, where when I would run, I would like think about what would make me angry, or I would think about like some of the stuff in my past. I mean, I know like we can't change the past, but there was a lot that I had to process there that I was holding on to for periods of my life. So that was effective. Changing the people that I spent time with was instrumental. I mean, I talk a lot now. I mean, as much as I say you should definitely be having conversations and spending time with people that are different than you, I think you got to, for me, what really helped was spending time with people that had common futures and not common pasts. Because I think what happens to a lot of people is they'll say—
I fucking love that, by the way. Common futures, that's awesome.
Yeah. Well, and I think the reason I think it's important is because a lot of times we'll stay in friendships or in inner circles because we've known that person for 15 years. We partied with that person for 10 years. So we feel some sense of loyalty to a certain friend or a certain friend group. And it wasn't that I felt that these people were inherently bad people. I just knew that the last time I spent a good amount of time with them, I got into some, you know, shady, you know, situations. And the main reason I knew it was time for me to kind of move on from those friend groups was as I got out of jail and I started to make progress in my health and fitness. And, you know, I went from like reading like High Times magazine before I went to jail to now I'm like reading Men's Muscle and Fitness, Men's Health, stuff like that, that I didn't have anything in common with them anymore. So I'd be around them, but it would feel like an awkward first date where they're like going out and getting high. And they're like, you want to come? I'm like, no, of course not. But And I would just be sitting there like figuring out how I'm going to get my protein in. Right. And so it just got to a point where I was like, man, like, this is just weird. Like, it's not even enjoyable for me to be able to spend time with these people. So I started to spend more time alone and hang out with my grandparents at home and watch TV and stuff like that, and learn to work on my inner self and what I actually wanted in certain relationships. You know, being of service has definitely been something that was very helpful for me, where, you know, when I first became a trainer, I found this new high in helping other people use fitness to change their lives in the same way that Eric helped me. So that was important. Spirituality has been instrumental, but not until like later on in my life, to where like around the same time I was talking about earlier, when I was struggling with the external validation and fitness piece, where people were telling me in my life, they're like, you need something else. Like, you need some spirituality in your life, whatever it is, because like, you just seems like that part of you is missing. And then having a relationship with God and becoming a Christian was very helpful in me understanding that even though God wasn't, or even though I wasn't proud of what I had done in my past, God was, because he was able to use that to help me transform my life and then to be able to do the work that I was doing to help others. And then that, you know, helped inspire me to improve the relationship with my mom and forgiveness and all that stuff I talked about earlier. And then the other thing, there's so many things, but the last thing I'll say is just this idea that it's up to me, and that if I focused on the version of me, which is why I love killed my clone thing that you say. It's like, if I focused on the version of me that was in the past before jail, and I focused on that and just thought about that the whole time, I would lose, because I would begin to justify certain things, and I would be able to assume that I'm going to be a certain way. And then my actions would start to match the way I thought in my head, and I would end up back down that path. Right. But I knew that if I could just do the best that I could every single day to do the exact things I knew I needed to do on that day, whether it was the certain people I needed to stay away from, whether it was certain activities from a health and fitness perspective, you know, certain foods or whatever, that it gave me a chance to become that person I wanted to be. And that it allowed me to become a better version of myself each and every day. And it was super incremental. As far as my relationship with my cellmate, he unfortunately passed away last year, which was really tough for me. Initially, when I got out, we would write letters to each other. And there was times where I got out like in the winter time. And part of my routine in jail was, you know, doing calisthenics and also running. And so in the winter, it was cold and I didn't feel like running. So in one of the letters, I told him, I was like, dude, it's cold, I don't feel like running. And he obviously said what I expected him to say, and, you know, said like, quit being a bitch or something to that effect, and being like, you know, I build machines, get out there and buy some sweatpants and go run. And I was just like, okay, you know, and went out and got sweatpants and started running. And we actually ended up meeting up and doing a couple actual workouts together, where I was actually able to keep up with what he was doing.
Oh, wow.
Which was really cool. And then, you know, he knew that, you know, he helped save my life. I dedicated my first book to him, and he just kind of went down a different path, unfortunately. But I guess the silver lining in him passing away was, I remember the moment he passed, his mom like reached out to me on Facebook and was just like, hey, you know, Eric, obviously you knew Eric, my son, really well, and he passed away and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, she invited me to come speak at the funeral. And then I had a family member reach out to me, which was this is honestly one of the coolest things, in that she was like, you know, I was looking through and, you know, I was finding out who he was connected to, and I somehow saw your name. And then I saw that you were, you know, were doing podcasts, and then I would listen to them, and I heard you share his story. And it made me happy, because I realized let me see like the good side of him that we always knew. And I just never knew that doing all of this would lead to that. Right. Yeah. And I think that's at the, you know, to tie this all together, it's like, that's kind of what this message has been, right? It's like, you know, you don't change everything overnight. You don't have, you know, a 10-year level of success overnight. But it's just taking responsibility for the here and now and doing everything you can that day. And then the next day doing the same thing and the same thing and the same thing. And then all that stuff starts to stack up. Right. And just like bad habits can compound, good habits compound as well.
So beautiful, Doug. And I really appreciate what you're doing. And I'm truly grateful that you're doing what you're doing. So thank you so much.
You're welcome, man. And thank you again for having me on.
Absolutely. I look forward to talking to you soon.
Sounds good, brother.
And now for the Q&A.
Today's question comes from Daniel.
Hi, Daniel.
Daniel says, I am writing to say thanks for all the content you produce in the realm of fitness and fat loss and for the inspiration you provide for helping people like me navigate the complex and confusing landscape of eating and health. He says, I've been on my fitness journey for some time now, working hard to form sensible habits and realistic goals to reduce my weight and lead a generally healthy lifestyle. He says, my question concerns that fundamental component, protein. So many times on your podcast, I've heard you and your guests talk about its benefits in all areas, body composition, weight loss, muscle building. He says, as a 6 foot tall, 38-year-old man weighing around 98 kilos, so I don't know what that is for pounds for us in the U.S.
It's times 2.2. 98 times 2.2.
Okay. Great. So 200. I'm not good with math.
Okay. 6 foot tall, 200 pounds.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. He says, I'm working on a fat loss goal to shed around 18 kilos to be living with a healthy body weight range. Okay. He says, I've heard you talk about with multiple guests on the show that we have to prioritize protein consumption. My question concerns whether this amount relates to my current weight or my target weight. Should I be consuming the amount of protein needed for my current weight or target weight goal? Figuring this out would reduce some anxiety. I always feel it's a struggle to get enough protein in my diet from healthy sources. Such a good question. Have this question.
It's a great question, and it can get so complicated. And like, a dude who's 500 pounds does not need to eat 500 grams of protein a day. That is not the case. Where it gets slightly more complicated is when you have a higher, when you're more muscular and you're thinking, like for me, it's a little bit easier for me to just round up to what my weight is than to try to go like, okay, if I'm 12% body fat or 14% body fat minus that, really you want to be eating it. I mean, ultimately it depends. If you're trying to build muscle and you're eating in a calorie surplus, you don't need to eat as much, honestly. Like, you still need to eat probably more than the average person does, but you don't need to eat your weight because your body's not going to be stealing those nutrients to do anything else. And so when you're in a caloric deficit and trying to reduce weight, you got to be pretty on that number, whatever it is. Honestly, my suggestion is to use some kind of an app to figure this out and calculate it. And you type in everything. And there's an Instagram called Train Bloom, who we've actually had on the podcast. And he has a great calculator, and it's free. If you go to his Instagram account, I think it's just at Train Bloom. He has a so you would enter all your information into it, and it will spit out the number of grams of protein you're supposed to eat. Really, you should be eating more closer to grams for, if you're very overweight, for your target, right? But I don't know when it gets into 18 kilos, because for me, my mind is always thinking of pounds. And if I was concentrating on losing 18 pounds, this would not affect my protein at all. But 18 kilos is double that. So that's like probably closer to 40 pounds. And then maybe it would a little bit, but I don't know exactly, because it does get really mathy. Okay. This stuff. And especially when we're talking about kilos, because then it's like 0.8 grams per kilo or something like that. And so I can't spit that number out. I'm not a calculator, but I would go to Train Bloom and do that math. And if not, I would just take the number you're aiming for and try to hit that. So if he's aiming for 70, it doesn't work out correctly. I don't know, 150 pounds, I would aim for 150 grams of protein. If that's his target weight.
You're okay, got it. More closer to the target than where you're at. Right, because like you said, if someone's 500 pounds, they don't have to eat 500 grams of protein every day. That's a lot.
Right, but also, if he's 180 pounds or 190 pounds and he's in a caloric deficit, that extra protein's not going to harm him,
Yeah.
It does get very complicated. And I'm sorry, I can't just give him a number. But I would say I've done it a few times where I've gone like, I lost a little weight. Let me type it into Train Bloom. And usually Train Bloom gives me around the number I'm eating. And to be completely honest with you, I don't think of these numbers as absolutes. Like if I'm trying to eat 250 grams of protein a day and I only get 230, I'm not up at night sweating over this. And sometimes I get 260. Sometimes I'm a little higher and sometimes I'm a little lower. I am not measuring out an ounce of chicken before I go to bed to make sure I get every gram of protein. But I'm getting as close as possible while still trying to live a life where I'm not weighing my food constantly. I'm really trying not to weigh my food anymore, which has seemed to be good for the last year.
Yeah, that's awesome. No, I get it. It's a little complex. Go ahead. What were you going to say?
If you are weighing your food, then weigh out the ounce of chicken. You know, that's okay too. I'm not saying you have to not do that. But if his ballpark is 150 grams to 180 grams, and I would think if he's eating anywhere near that much, because that's a fair amount of protein, that he's going to be okay.
Yeah. Awesome. Okay, good. Well, hope that helps. Let us know if it does and how you do on your goal. Good luck to you with that. Thank you for sending in your question. For anyone else who wants to ask Ethan a question, we love to read your questions. You can email them to us. hello@americanglutton.net.
And I will send you where I would go to get the answer.
Amazing. Love it.
Thanks for listening to this episode of American Glutton. I'm Ethan Suplee. You can follow us on Instagram @American Glutton Podcast. Sincerely.